Every time a young person brings a gun to school and opens fire, there's a bunch of questioning after the fact. Could we have known in advance that the shooter was likely to do this? What are the signs we should have been watching for? We have a couple of guests who have heard those questions and many more and have some answers for them. They both have experience assessing potential threats from students. John Van Driel is a school psychologist and the director of safety and risk management for Salem Kaiser Schools in Oregon, and the editor and principal author of a book called Assessing Student Threats, a Handbook for Implementing the Salem Kaiser System. John Van Driel, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Very, very good to have you. Jeffrey Sprague is with us as well. He's a professor of special education at the University of Oregon and the co-director of the U of O's Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Sprague.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here as well.
So, John, I mean, you literally wrote the book on assessing student threats. Tell us about the creation of the Salem Kaiser System and what you were able to work with as a starting point.
Well, we anticipated the need to be doing more work with our kids that were headed down a continuum of more of an extreme aggression, like violence and targeted violence, in the late 90s. And so we started organizing target focus groups to discuss that, and they were multi-agency, multidisciplinary groups. And from those groups, we developed a protocol and an assessment process that developed into a system. And the material we used was initially the information that was available in the 90s on kind of predicting aggression. And we moved very quickly to situational or scenario-based assessment, having implemented the information from the Safe Schools Initiative and an FBI monograph and some other research sets of the early 21st century into our process. And that helped us develop the system and the collaborative group we now call the Student Threat Assessment Team. Eventually, after working on that system and refining it with lots of feedback from the community and the schools, along with further research sets, I figured that we had enough to write the book. And so I authored that, engineered it, and I'm the principal author, but I have a few other contributing authors as well who assisted me in putting that project together.
So the idea of assessing threats, though, was there was some science already out there. It was just sort of tailoring it a little more to a school-type environment?
Yes. Well, we were provided from the Safe Schools Initiative a list of risk factors and the kinds of questions you might ask. And I might note that that particular study was one of two that really moved people away from predictive profiling and assessing the individual person and guided them towards assessing the situation that the person or persons were in. And so those studies were very helpful. What I did is I took that information and I made it work within a K-12 environment, taking into consideration all of the regulations that we find within education and all the rules about specialized instruction and disability and discipline. And that was something that was difficult to navigate. Fortunately, I had plenty of experience within that environment and spoke the language.
Jeffrey Sprague, I want to turn to you at the Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior. It's not part of the name, but it looks like IVDB is very focused on school shooters.
We began in the early 90s with my colleague Hill Walker. There was great concern at that time about the rise in violent juvenile crime in general, and that was the genesis of our institute. And then we started to see in the middle 90s the more famous school shootings, capped by obviously Thurston here in Springfield, and then ultimately Columbine. So we happened to be at the time one of the groups that had been focusing on, again, beginning with youth violence in general, but then also the school shooting phenomena occurred, which was really unique in the history of school safety. So yes, we have had a focus on that for many years.
And then, so I noticed that it is the Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior, and I think what I was picking up from what John was saying, that you are looking at behaviors and not necessarily individuals. So it's a difference between profiling a person and seeing behaviors that could be trouble.
Yes, we've definitely always advocated not that the profiling as we know it does not work. There are just too many variables that come together that could be shared with a person who does a mass school shooting, but there's so much intercorrelated with other factors. It's just not the way to go statistically, if you will. Or functionally.
We're talking about assessments of young people who potentially could try to commit violence in a school with Jeffrey Sprague, who is the director, co-director of the UO Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior with Hill Walker. John Van Driel, a psychologist, director of safety and risk management at Salem-Keizer Public Schools. You have a part in the conversation if you want it. Your questions welcome at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. John, in reading part of the book, Assessing Student Threats, for which you are the editor and principal author, you say the system is neither reactive nor punitive, which is intriguing in itself. What are some of the basic principles?
Well, we start by begin the process by defining our concerns about the behavior, and the first step is to identify within an aggression continuum the kinds of situation or behavior and what that supports as far as an outcome. There are a lot of aggressive students in our schools, and we have a lot of means by which to address that. And it's important to note that we're just going to use the word typically aggressive student, which is to some degree developmental, is reactive, is usually responding to some sort of either threat or offense in the moment. They don't plan to come to school to be aggressive. And that is different than someone who is planning and plotting to carry out an attack. And I don't mean just a school shooting, but, you know, a targeted bullying kind of event or some sort of retaliation physically that would cause somebody enough harm to put them in the hospital. So a severe or lethal kind of injury. And we start differentiating that so that we know where we're headed when it comes to intervention. Our process then sorts that out through a series of questions and conversations. We don't use a threshold or a number or a magic kind of a statistical predictive equation to decide where we're going.
It's really a little less matrix-based and a little more feeling-based?
Yeah. We're not doing that. We're very contextual in defining where the risk factors are and the kinds of either behaviors or triggering events that are elevating, you know, the possibility that someone would act out. And then we simply address those with prevention strategies and supervision strategies. And this is what I mean by not punitive. We are not a discipline process. Our goal isn't to remove kids from schools. Our goal is to keep kids in schools where we can supervise them and change their behavior to be more pro-social and be a part of our community and have positive meaning within the school environment and their lives. In other words, we're trying to make them better citizens. And so punitive measures, restrictions of liberty tend to defeat that purpose, and you end up with kids that feel excluded and possibly have can build their motive for hurting people. Now, there are times when you do have to restrict a youth's liberty because of the safety the potential risk that youth is posing at the time. But we try to move kids as quickly back into the school environment with the right supervision and intervention strategies. So I really see our system as a prevention system. The people that work within our system, from the different agencies that participate, county mental health, law enforcement, juvenile justice, and the school districts, we all work with that as our goal. I mean, that's kind of our bumper sticker: keep kids in school, supervise them, and create a safer, more anxiety-free environment in the process.
Jeffrey Sprague, what are then some of the things that are going to cause people to get annoyed enough to commit some kind of aggression? And do you give a little leeway for some acting out before you move in and begin to make more concrete assessments?
Yeah, there's a lot of, as John mentioned, there's an early FBI study, which sadly hasn't been repeated for many years. Many of the school shooters, for example, are victims of bullying behavior that maybe they perceive as having not been addressed, not being connected to school. Obviously, I think one thing you mentioned a bit earlier, I think you said it was feeling-based. What John is describing really is what in the research world we call a multi-gate procedure, where if there's an initial concern that comes about, then you ask those early questions, and then those questions would guide, they're meant to guide the judgment of the professionals in school, not replace it, as John said, with thresholds. Really critical things, particularly in the area of school shootings, is, you know, does the youth have access to weapons? And then is it a transient threat? In other words, is it just words, or is there actually evidence that the youth or the child, typically the youth, has a concrete plan, coming down that way? Virtually all the school shooters have been Caucasian males. There have been a few females that have made attempts in that regard. But then again, the remaining characteristics, you know, disconnection from school, bully victimization, you know, maybe you can say fascination with guns, but lots of kids are bully victims. Lots of kids have fascination with guns. There's a lot of Caucasian males and females in schools. That alone, without having an understanding of the context, as has already been said, that the youth is functioning in, isn't helpful. And that goes back to the criticism of profiling. You know, is it? I know the 10 characteristics that will predict the next school shooter just isn't going to work in that
regard.
Not
that simple. Okay, yeah. Is it somewhat easier, Jeffrey, I wonder, with young people, because they are still learning. They're still learning how to express their emotions. They're still learning how to conceal their emotions is a big one.
Yeah. Some of the best published research we have is actually out of the state of Virginia, where they actually require anonymous reporting of these school threat assessment results. So obviously, child's name removed. But our colleague Dewey Cornell is the lead there. He's at University of Virginia. That younger kids are more likely to make what are called the transient threats. I'm going to shoot you. I'm going to kill you. Type of thing, without a plan or a means. And then older kids, as would probably make logical sense, tend to be more likely to actually have a plan in addition to giving some kind of verbal or other indication that they're going to perpetrate an event. But I think it's important to say, too, there's a lot of concern, and this is not blaming the media. These are incredibly low-rate events, and the public probably has the perception that this is happening more than ever, and certainly these mass shootings create that perception. But we've had school-related violent homicide at a relatively stable level since the Centers for Disease Control has been tracking it, even before the early 90s. And so it's very difficult to make inferences from this very small number. And one of the things that John and I told the Oregon State Board of Ed a few weeks ago before the Texas shooting was, statistically that's interesting, but the loss of even a single life is obviously totally unacceptable. So we have to do everything we can to prevent. But it's hard to make an inference about whether any of this is effective.
Right, but not a lot of wavering in the numbers, you say, over time. Those have been fairly stable.
Yeah, and what we say, statistics turn 1,000 tears into one. Somewhere between about 16, up to 40 some in a given year. I think this year will be high just because of the single incidents with the mass shootings. But again, if it's your kid, 15 or 45 doesn't matter.
No, it truly doesn't. Jeffrey Sprague at the University of Oregon, John Van Driel at Salem-Keizer Schools. We're talking about assessing potential threats from students in school. So John Van Driel, you were talking about you want to make sure you get the students worked back into the school environment. Is there a prescribed period of time that often works, or is that also on a case-by-case basis?
It's completely that. And maybe I can tie this in a little bit to the question you asked, Jeff, and what we look for, and then how we address it, and we want schools to be peaceful places where kids can relax and let their brains do what their brains are designed to do in a learning environment, and fear will interfere with that. So what we do in threat assessment is we address all of the kinds of aggression that might cause someone to be in fear, but we really focus on what we call targeted and aggression. And in doing that, we're centering our analysis on the facts and evidence of the behavior in a given situation, and that's specific. It's not a general daily routine like a kid who just is generally aggressive. And that's an appraisal of risk that focuses on actions, communications. I think Jeff mentioned some of this, actions, communications, and circumstances that suggest that student or students intend to mount an attack, and then they're engaged in the planning and preparing to do that. So transient threat would be the communication, and what we're going to focus on then is the behavior that would support that communication. And in doing that, we're looking at some unique dynamics between student, perpetrator, the student body, and those are the dynamics that we then address. And if we can do that successfully within the school, and we really do try, I think about 19 out of 20 of the students we work with stay in school, and the 20th is maybe gone for a small amount of time, but usually returns to us or to a school somewhere. But if we can address those dynamics, that behavior, and those risk factors that are elevating the chance of someone following through on their communication, that's the prevention side. And often we can do that very quickly within the day or within the week. Again, trying to avoid a sense of exclusion, and further alienation that some of these kids really feel anyway.
So don't suspend, don't expel.
Yeah, well, and the thing about expulsion is if the student is targeting or after someone in your school and they're outside the school and they're not well supervised, you're at greater risk. It's than if you have them, under your protective wing and they know they're being supervised and you have not only strategies but activities that kind of realign them with the pro-social goals of the school. And that has been proven over and over again to be a successful process in bringing kids, turning kids away from that trajectory I just talked about, where their behavior starts to head towards supporting the idea of hurting someone.
Well, clearly a lot of work has gone into this, and there's a lot more work ahead. It's good to hear from both of you about this, about assessing potential threats within schools. John Van Driel, school psychologist and director of safety and risk management at Salem-Keizer Schools, editor and principal author of Assessing Student Threats. Jeffrey Sprague, professor of special education at the University of Oregon and the co-director of the U of O's Institute on Violence and Destructive Behavior. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
My pleasure.
Yes, indeed. Thanks.